Welcome to the Flow Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording, and it is 3:10 p.m. and Central Time. Today is August 19th, and today being Friday, it's the big picture, long term, audio and video for the various different asset classes. I thought we'd kick off with Apple, and this is a decade of history. So they've consolidated the share quite a few times, so it's now trading at $171. We just go back and look at where the prices were back in 2008. It's really a long way from where it is now. And in the intervening decade, it's become the largest company in the world, at least that's not state-owned. Then let's just think about, well, what did the consistency of the trend look like? So back in 2008, the share bottomed early. And then rallied very aggressively, so that by the time we get around to the end of 2009, it's testing the previous peak and breaking out. And in the intervening decade, we have a series of ranges, one above another. There have been multiple occasions in which it tested the region of the 1,000-day moving average. Now, we can't say that we have a series of ranges, one above another, any longer. And there is absolutely no question that the share price accelerated in 2020 because it went from 50 to 180 in the space of 18 months. Then we had a good sized pullback earlier on this year. We've had an exceptionally impressive rebound. And the most important thing is that the setback pulled back into the underlying trading range. So it hasn't done that for quite a while. And now we're back in the region of the peaks. So there's one thing I think is less well appreciated by investors. And that is, if you look at Apple, it's a highly cyclical company. And most of the revenue comes from the iPhone. And that is $191 billion out of $297 billion. And then if you look at revenue from the iPhone, there's a three-year cycle. So sales went up a lot in 2021. And they're probably quite good in 2022 as well. But has the cyclicality of the business changed? And I think that is no. Then we can also just go back and think about what else the company is doing. Well, it's services. Now, everything that Apple does in terms of services is inside the walled garden of the App Store. So they have Apple Music, but Spotify is a better business. And I really don't know anybody that's a prolific user of Apple Music. Spotify, having rebounded quite impressively for 6 weeks, is rolling over again in here today. So I think we can say with confidence, it's hard to make money in music. Now let's think about games. Well, Apple doesn't produce the games. They just charge a tax on people using the games. Then they charge a tax on in-app purchases. And that's then representative of a large proportion of their services income. But there's the other challenge, and it is that only a very small proportion of people account for the vast majority of expenditure on services like games. So therefore, you don't have a linear growth trajectory between the number of people who have a phone, the revenue that comes from services. So that's rather difficult. Now, it's not like Apple doesn't make money. They do, and they make rather a lot of it, and their margin has been improving. But that doesn't mean that it's not a cyclical company. And now we are in the aftermath of a massive increase in money supply. So we have a lot of people who were able to afford a new phone. And as money supply tightens, as interest rates rise, then the capability to afford successively new phones every year Well, that's not going to hold water. So the share is overbought in the short term and looks susceptible to additional weakness. Now, this is just one of the Fangman shares. Let's just look at how has that index of companies been doing. Well, the first thing is that it's rebounded back into the region of the 200-day moving average. So instead of having a total market cap of 12 trillion, we're now at around 10 trillion. So the size of the market cap has contracted by 20, excuse me, by 2 trillion over the course of this year. And this is a consistent downtrend. We had a contraction of 2 trillion, then a rebound of 1 trillion, then an even bigger contraction of 3 trillion, but a rebound of 1 trillion, well, 2 trillion in this occasion. So we're now in this lower side of the overhead trading range and the region of the 200-day moving average. This is the first area of potential resistance. And then let's think about these companies relative to the wider stock market. So there's been a range that's been underway now for most of the last 2 years, and a succession of lower rally highs since December, a failed upside break, a lower rally high in March. Potentially, what we're looking at right now is another lower rally high. I've been quite clear in stating that this bull market would be unlikely to end until the Fangman shares break down relative to the wider market. But that looks more likely now than it has in quite a while. One thing that we've certainly seen, and I think there's a lot of argument going on right now about the NASDAQ 100. So it pulled back in a dynamic manner and found support in the region of the 1,000-day moving average. Now, in a secular bull market, buying the dip always works. So we've seen plenty of occasions where the index has pulled back into the region of the 1,000-day moving average over the last decade. So let's just remind ourselves what has been the animating factor behind the big bull market since 2008. And I think there's no argument there. It's been liquidity driven. We've had successive rounds of massive monetary accommodation every time the market has pulled back. So the market pulled back on this occasion, and there was widespread anticipation that the Federal Reserve is imminently going to pivot, that within 6 months we'll be back into lower interest rates and asset price inflation once more. So there is no need to sell, there's no need to liquidate positions, because within a matter of months, the price will be back to new highs, and anyone who has sold will then be sitting in cash and hoping that they have the courage to jump back in. So you're better off not selling, and therefore, in fact, what you should be doing is committing any additional capital you have, because we're in the region of the 1,000-day moving average. And this is an ideal buying opportunity. So we've had a powerful short covering rally taking place, and it has sucked in investors from all over the world, and there is clear abiding fear that people have missed the buying opportunity. But all of this has happened against a background where central banks are still fighting inflation. So the Federal Reserve has raised rates by 75 basis points twice. we're back in the region of where interest rates were in 2019. And they're due to raise rates by at least 50 basis points in September. Now, for those who are willing to bet that we're already at the top of the interest rate cycle, then they're placing a lot of their bets on the Jackson Hole meeting, which is going to be next week. So they're anticipating that central bankers gathering from around the world will use the conference as an opportunity to say that inflationary pressures have peaked and that the historically swift pace of tightening is over. So that's a good reason why we've had a big run-up in stock prices over the last 6 weeks. And there is certainly an element of buy the rumor and sell the news to this event. So, when we think about how inflation is measured, owner's equivalent rent is far and away the most or the biggest weighting. And we're at levels now that haven't been seen in years. So that's going to continue to put upward pressure on inflation. A lot of the compression that we've seen in inflationary measures has been about oil. So oil prices have come back down, and they're now right in the region of about $100. So that's a good sized pullback. And the price now is distributing below the trend mean. So we're in a rather delicate situation. If the price pushes back up through $100, well, then any of the downward pressure that we've seen on energy and lead inflation is going to quickly be erased. So these are, I think, we're at a very interesting place right now. A good part of the reason why prices have been going sideways is because the USA let supply out from the Strategic Reserve, so that balanced the market for a while. But Russia is a big spinner. Now, they've been able to sustain their production in a really quite a heroic manner, considering that all the Western workers left the country and they're not able to import any of the tools that they need. So that means that domestically, their production of equipment has certainly improved. And then OPEC is already pumping at close to capacity. Of course, we're also in an environment where a lot of environmental regulations have been imposed. So it's not like the world has run out of oil, but rather we've decided in many parts of the world not to produce it. And then on that, in response to that, natural gas prices are very strong. So US natural gas prices are back in the region of $9. So this has been a really quite impressive rebound. And natural gas producers are doing really quite well. One of the Canadian smaller operators is rebounding very recently. Birchcliff Energy has chattered that they're going to be massively increasing their dividend in response to this big move in natural gas prices. But lagging the natural gas price overall, but of course, the point is that the higher prices are sustained, then the more likely it is that the benefits are going to compound on the balance sheet. And Devon Energy has also rebounded in a really emphatic fashion. Of course, the US natural gas market is very much continental based. The advent of LNG is a really different phenomenon for the market because it's creating some form of fungibility. But the big challenge for Europe is that import capacity is already at its peak, and the price is going berserk. We've had a doubling and more in the price in the space of little more than 8 weeks. So this is an incredible acceleration. And Russia announced today that they're going to shut down the Nord Stream pipeline for 3 days and are saying that it will start up again and then it will run at 20% capacity. So Germany has done an heroic job of refilling their gas storage facilities, and it is likely to be at the 80% level by the 1st of October. But gas storage is not about replacement. It's about supplemental supply during the peak demand phase. And it implies, or it assumes, that there will continue to be gas supplies during winter. And there's obviously the real possibility that Russia could simply switch the gas off in the middle of winter, and Europe gets cold winters. So this is obviously a very difficult environment, and it's in no uncertain terms creating an energy crisis in Europe. So this is obviously a different kind of inflation. When we think about the kinds of things that create recessions, well, one is monetary tightening, that central banks withdraw liquidity. They're worried about economic overheating, and they withdraw liquidity. It has a lagged effect, so it's not apparent immediately, but the effects are cumulative. The longer it lasts, the greater the effects are. And then the economy starts to contract because companies see that there's less liquidity, unemployment starts to rise, sales decline, valuations contract, and prices come down. So that's one way that inflation can create, or that, excuse me, that recessions start. So monetary tightening. But then energy is a tax on consumption. So when energy prices go up in a really profound manner, exceptionally quickly, well, then it has a really deleterious effect on consumption. Now we're certainly starting to see that some, at least, of the demand component is moderate. Companies like Norsk Hydro have been closing facilities. We've seen the zinc smelters closing in the Netherlands this week as well. So the higher prices go, then the greater the likelihood is that some of the demand component will be elastic and will be taken out of the market. But then you're going to have other factors that simply can't be taken out. So we're looking at the very significant potential that there are going to be deep recessions in Europe. And then let's just think about the stock markets. So the DAX index has pulled back, but the peak was at 16,000, and we're currently close to 14,000. But it's pulling back in a reasonably dynamic manner again now from the region of the 200-day moving average. So there's certainly the potential that prices are going to come down further from here. Then let's think about the Euro Stoxx index. So this has an almost identical chart pattern, and it is also susceptible to additional downside from here. And then if we look at the FTSE 250, well, it's been more volatile. Perhaps, but and also already below the peak from late 2019, but encountering resistance now in the region of the 200-day and the 1,000-day moving. as well. So companies have pulled back, and I guess we saw the biggest pullback first, immediately after the announcement of the war. Subsequently, a rebound, and then successively smaller rebounds, and still a succession of lower rally highs. And against this background, inflationary pressures are, of course, ramping higher. So, when we think then about everything that's going on right now, we have first bond yields ramping higher. And particularly in the UK, we have this very impressive upper dynamic in here this week. And the more back history we look at, the greater the likelihood is that one will conclude that the trend on the downside is over, or at the very minimum, that the zero bound really is as low as it gets, and that we will be in an exceptionally volatile base formation. But this has certainly been the biggest advance we've seen since the initial pop on the upside during the recession in the 1990s. And that was also the time when people got really worried about property prices. Of course, property prices subsequently went through the absolute roof. And that was also during an exceptionally lengthy period where interest rates did nothing but decline. So now interest rates are rising. So not only do we have the pressure from energy prices, which is a tax on consumption, which obviously means that you have to pay more to do less. And bull markets are really about paying less to do more. Well, then this is obviously problematic. But then we also have tightening liquidity conditions. So central banks are in the very difficult position that they have very high headline inflation, and their singular mandate is to try and ensure price stability. And of course, this is particularly embarrassing for central banks that have an inflation target, because they are miles away from that inflation target. Now, there's absolutely nothing that a central bank can do about energy prices. But the reality is that energy independence hasn't been a national priority for most countries for a long time, because prices weren't really that challenging. Natural gas, in particular, hasn't been in a bull market for an awfully long time. And this is the result of a secular bull market, excuse me, of a secular bear market. If we look at the long-term chart of natural gas, it popped on the upside because of increasing demand, and then also because we hadn't seen any new discoveries for a long time. And then there were hurricanes that really hit the offshore sector in a profound manner all the way through to about 2008. And then prices collapsed. And the one thing that happens during a secular bear market is, first, no new investment goes into developing new mines. And then subsequently, demand increases because the relative value proposition is just too attractive. So then you start to see people using more natural gas. And of course, what's happened in the USA in particular is that they just substituted natural gas for coal. And that ticked lots of boxes on the environmental regulation front. And we've seen that demand for natural gas has increased in an exceptionally impressive manner. So obviously, this worked wonderfully well during the secular bear, but now it's broken out. And now there's an acute demand for gas from the international market. And if that's not an example of a new source of demand arriving following the end of a secular bear market, then I don't know what is. So the creation of the global LNG market is creating a globally fungible price for natural gas. And it means that prices can go higher in North America, and they might eventually help to mitigate additional supply hikes in price internationally. But the price right now is right in the region of the peak from earlier this year and could go higher from here. So this is, and of course, the more LNG export facilities that the USA builds, then the greater the likelihood that the higher price environment will be sustained because of that very wide arbitrage between the USA and the rest of the world. Now, ultimately, other major exporters of gas will also build LNG facilities and build more pipelines. And of course, the re-entry of Iran into the global community would be transformative because they could build pipelines to Pakistan, they could put the pipeline through Pakistan, even into India, they could build pipelines to Turkey, or they could, and of course, but one of the things that Iran wants to do is use the territory they've gained political control of. Going across Iran, Iraq, Syria, and into Lebanon, and then have the pipeline empty into the Mediterranean. So there's certainly the potential for some of the geopolitical choke points in the world to ease off in response to very high prices, but probably going to lay the foundations for significant geopolitical problems of the future at the same time. At the moment, at least, prices continuing to push higher. So, what is it that could bring down inflation? Well, money supply has, money supply growth has already peaked. So, some of that is already coming out, and that would at least remove some of the monetary inflation. But then financial conditions have eased up significantly because stocks have rebounded. And one of the easiest ways to bring inflation down would be to hit demand. But demand hasn't really been hit. And I think that the most likely scenario is that we're going to have a great deal of volatility. So I think when we look at lumber prices, we have examples of exceptional volatility. And the price was up in a really dynamic manner last week and then gave up a lot of it in here this week. Housing starts are deteriorating. So that's certainly having an impact. In terms of mortgage rates came down a bit, now they're going back up again. So the affordability of the housing stock is at levels now that haven't been seen since 2006. Now, one big challenge here is that the price failed to sustain the move above 3.25% on the 10-year treasury. And pulled back into the region of the 200-day moving average. And now it's bouncing. And this is the upper side of the base formation. So if the yield breaks back above 3.25, well, the chances are then that the next area of potential resistance is going to be around 4% or potentially 5%. And that would be, I think, undeniably contractually. Now, let's just look at some of the lead indicators for future recessions. The yield curve spread is now at negative 26 basis points. So this has been a meaningful rebound. And what it's beginning to suggest is that investors are now pricing in the potential that interest rate hikes will go on from here, and that the most benign scenario would be that interest rate hikes end soon. But if they persist from here, then the question about whether there's going to be a recession or not will be pretty much settled, and that we will certainly be moving into a recession. Now, there was obviously a lot of argument over the last month because we had two quarters of negative growth. But the and of course, that's the technical definition of a recession. But we've never had a recession where the Purchasing Managers Index wasn't below 50. So it's not going to be updated again until the 1st of September. And it might be below 50 then, but it's not below 50 yet. So that is an argument that it's still early. We haven't had a recession, even though we've had negative growth rates. And there's still an argument that those negative growth rates are more technical than real. And then we have unemployment. Now, unemployment and underemployment are, I think, important considerations. There's a well understood phenomenon that the unemployment condition is not truly reflective of the real economy. When you have people that are not in the economy, then you also have people who have been able to come out of the economy because they are disabled in some definable way. And you have people that have never worked, so they don't get counted as employed. I think that this is one of the big challenges that you have about. There's a very large double-digit number of young men who've never worked or only work part-time for and this is one of the things that is common enough that it would take 4 or 5 weeks or 10 weeks of summer employment so that they get enough of stamps or tokens to qualify for unemployment benefits, and then they go on unemployment for the winter. So this is obviously underemployment, but it's also representative of indigent, or basically these people are indigent and that they're just not working. Now, how do you get people like that to work? One of the biggest challenges with telling everyone to go home in 2020 was trying to get them to go back to work. But then you have to count them. And the unemployment rate at 3.5%, and this job openings figure at in excess of 12 million, that those two figures don't gel. And then you have this large proportion of the male population that doesn't work at all. So there are, I think, significant challenges in the social fabric underneath these official statistics that aren't well captured. And then you have to think about what's going to happen in the broader environment. So central banks are worried about inflation and they're worried about higher energy prices. and they're worried about their credibility. And they want to repair all of that. And they want to also ensure that the policies that they implement are effective in supporting growth and employment. But at the moment, we have high rent, high food, high energy prices, high inflation, and wages that are not keeping up with inflation. And obviously, if oil prices rally from here, it would be undeniably contractionary. So if you're a central bank, and like the Federal Reserve, then you've only got two mandates. The two mandates are full employment and price stability. They don't have price stability. They do have officially full employment. Therefore, they have the potential to raise rates until unemployment starts to rise. And this willingness of the USA to raise rates is obviously a really significant factor in supporting gold. Excuse me, the dollar, and negative for gold. Now, we don't always have an inverse relationship between gold and the dollar. And I think that if we look at what I consider the real rate of inflation, I don't like looking at the TIPS market as a real rate of inflation, because it's manipulated by the Fed, and the Fed owns about a quarter of all the issues. But the reality is that we've had a negative real interest rate environment for the vast majority of time for the last 12 years. So a negative real interest rate environment is certainly a good to have, but it is not a sufficient condition for a secular bull market gold. Gold prices have gone up and down a lot in the last decade. Since 2011, we've had an acceleration, then a big decline. Prices lost about 45% of the advance, and then a big rebound in 2018 through 2020. And now prices are pulling back from the $1,800 level. So at the moment, we have a negative real interest rate environment, but it's getting less negative. And we have a very strong dollar environment. So when we have a negative real interest rate environment that's not as negative, and a strong dollar, that's not good for gold. And the price is coming back now in a dynamic manner in here this week. So this does look potentially like we could see significantly lower levels if the dollar continues to rebound. And the dollar's trend is really quite consistent. It came back to test the 105 level, and it has rebounded in a very emphatic fashion. Now, is the dollar going to remain the strongest currency in the world indefinitely? Well, probably not. But as long as the Federal Reserve is willing to raise rates faster than every other developed market, then the dollar is likely to continue to be the strongest currency. Of course, the other side is the euro is under really quite extraordinary duress. So the price is now back testing parity and could easily break downwards in here over the course of the next few weeks. The energy crisis for Europe is extremely profound. At least the UK doesn't have a reliance on pipeline gas from Russia, but the pound looks susceptible to additional downside. Now, let's just think about monetary and political solutions for inflation. The monetary solution is to massively reduce liquidity. If you suck liquidity out of assets, asset prices will come down, and animal spirits will take a big hit, and we'll see investment returns turn super negative. And we've already seen that pension funds have had a very difficult first half of this year because both bonds and equities went down. So obviously that's problematic, but it does help to kill off demand and rebalance the supply-demand phenomenon. And of course, what it also means is that living standards go down. And this is happening particularly, it's particularly relevant in Europe because it's a price taker for energy. Then you have the government solutions. So the first is price controls. If the government thinks that the energy crisis is temporary, then they're justified in introducing price controls. Right. There's a growing social phenomenon in the UK called Enough is Enough, and they are animating for price controls. So it would be quite normal for, in this kind of situation, for a government to say, right, we're not going to allow energy prices to rise, and we're going to introduce price caps. We have lots of examples of that kind of activity in emerging markets. And if they're right and their gamble pays off, that energy price acceleration is temporary, well, then the quantity of money spent in service to trying to control living standards and the potential for social unrest, well, then it's justified. And price controls are by far the more favorable solution than rampant wage hikes. Because the one thing that central banks in particular will be particularly cautious of and will have absolutely no choice to tighten into would be a wage price spiral. So, what happens in terms of government policy is going to be particularly profound. If they do introduce price controls, then and not just in the UK, but right across Europe, well, that might work for a while. But if energy prices don't come down and we are going to remain in this difficult environment, the cost of sustaining those price controls becomes incredibly prohibitive. So obviously that's challenging. Now, one thing that I think is also particularly worth considering is you've got companies like Blackstone, and they successfully bought millions of residential homes during the foreclosure crisis about a decade ago and turned into one of the biggest landlords in the world. And they're raising another $50 billion fund to buy properties in the event that prices come back in a big way. And that will be a big step towards the USA becoming a nation of renters. And when the renters outnumber the owners, well, then you get the real potential for rent control edicts. And laws against large landowners. So, this would obviously be a populist move. One of the big challenges for somewhere like the UK is lots of people own their homes, and there's a massive generational divide in there. But on top of that, you have a lot of people who've been investing in buy-to-let. So there's a large number of smaller landowners or landlords. And if we continue to see rent prices out of control and living standards for regular people that are being pressured in a really dynamic fashion, well, then that is going to result in governmental changes, more regulation and less regard for free market economics. So we saw lots of rent control edicts in the 1970s, and it was in direct response to inflation that was getting out of control and stayed that way. And that was the last time in the developed world we had wage price spirals. So it's a real possibility right now because we have monetary inflation and energy inflation. And these are obviously one is affecting the other, but they haven't just gone away. And even though we might be at the peak, just because we're at the peak doesn't mean that the acceleration higher has to accelerate lower. We could be at the peak for inflation and we could come back down to 6% or 7% inflation, and that would still be way above target. Of course, inflation also eats away at some of the government debts. So these are, I think, rather important that we've obviously seen very significant advances in energy prices and in yields. And a lot of debt, it has got very short durations. So refinancing is going to be very problematic. One thing that I think people are increasingly aware of is that 10% or more of the money that was issued during the Inflation Reduction Act in the USA was allocated to the IRS. So the USA is going to be much more forthright in collecting taxes. And that's obviously a very populist measure. So in the event that interest rates go up, then there are going to be very clear efforts underway to ensure that the government gets its share. And I've seen quite a bit of commentary in online forums about the job descriptions for all the new IRS agents, and one of them is a willingness to use lethal force and carry a weapon. Well, whoever said that the pen was mightier than the sword? But the reality is that we're moving progressively towards less regard for capital markets and more political interference in price setting. So this is problematic, and I think when we think about the logic of the Federal Reserve riding to the rescue, thought that I just illustrated this chart, and we have lots of instances where the market pulled back by 10 to 20%, and the Fed rode to the rescue, and that did not happen the last time, and that's a very clear difference. And until we see evidence of the Federal Reserve declaring victory, then it would be, I think, foolhardy to rely on the low holding. We're going to be in for more volatility. Markets went up an awful lot. We've had a huge acceleration on the upside in 2020 and 2021. And we've had a significant step lower in the first half of this year. We've had a big rebound, but monetary conditions are still tightening. So, and the lead indicators for future recessions are growing increasingly brightly red. And the high yield bond spread trended higher and popped above 500 basis points in May, June, pulled back and is now putting in a higher reaction low. And what this suggests to me, at least, is that smaller companies and less credit-worthy companies are starting to roll over. And this was a big downward dynamic this week on the high yield bond. So I sold out of my NASDAQ short 3 weeks ago, and I felt naked without it. So I put it back on last week, and it moved back into profit in here today. We're back in the region of the 200-day moving average. Shorting the NASDAQ in the region of the 200-day moving average was a good thing to do in March. And now we're encountering resistance in this level once more. When I think about the companies that have done best over the last decade, AMD, for example, has gone from practically nothing to $160, is now back at 100 and still trending downwards. And just like Apple's a cyclical business, semiconductors are a cyclical business. And the Philadelphia Semiconductors Index is in the region of the 200-day moving average and encountering resistance here as well. India's market, having really shown very impressive relative strength, posted a downside Q reversal today. So that still holds the sequence of lower rally highs, and it looks increasingly likely that prices will continue downwards from here. There's no market is going to be immune from tightening global liquidity. So then let's think about China. And the CSI 300 is hovering here and hasn't really gone back. But the renminbi is breaking downwards. So the renminbi hit a new low in here today. Now, China has lots of competing priorities. They want to try and support the property market. And there were some efforts today to ensure that fresh loans will be supplied to property developers. And they want to support consumers. They want to ensure that there's a vibrant domestic consumer economy. And obviously, they want to support the export market. They want to ensure that there's lots of additional money coming in from exports. But you can't do all that and then also spend money to support the currency. There's only so much money. So if they're going to maintain the peg, then they will have less money to spend on all the domestic priorities. If they allow the currency to devalue, then they will have that extra cash to deploy in all those domestic priorities. Now, they might decide that they're going to abandon the COVID zero policy, but I don't think that that's really an option open to China until they sort out their property problem. The one really attractive quality of COVID zero is that it keeps people in their home city, and it's difficult to migrate around, and it's difficult to organize popular protests beyond one's domestic or local community. If they were to abandon COVID zero, it would be a lot easier to travel around China. So the control and limitations imposed by COVID zero are attractive from the perspective of the government. And it's very unlikely they're going to risk popular protests ahead of Xi Jinping confirming himself as leader for life. But the renminbi has broken downwards. So there's obviously the potential here that they will allow the currency to devalue in order to support the domestic economy. Of course, a devaluing currency in a high energy price environment is also inflationary. And China's inflation has been very much under control. They avoided the big monetary spend of the rest of the world during the pandemic, and in fact benefited from, well, let's just put it this way, during the credit crisis, it was China's stimulus rescued the rest of the world. And during the pandemic, it was the stimulus in North America and Europe rescued China. So China didn't have the debt problem this time, but now they are going to experience inflation if the currency price or the currency value continues to deteriorate. The challenges China has aren't going to evaporate overnight, and they're going to have to stimulate. So if they do stimulate, then that is also going to enhance inflationary pressures. And this is, I think, one of the more important points. The value of exports might, in fact, decline because the currency goes down. But China isn't going to be able to sustain that. They don't have the large numbers of young, cheap workers. So the export model isn't what it was in the past. And China exported deflation for most of the last 20 years. And it's very arguable whether they're going to be able to continue to do that. And against a background where industrial resources are still really quite expensive. Now, copper prices were in positive territory today, and we're still at unwinding this deep oversold condition. With oil prices steady, then demand for renewables will likely be enhanced both by regulation and a demand for an alternative. And of course, China is a major exporter of those. And we are seeing some price competition creeping into the solar sector in China. And one of the reasons why the solar sector didn't fire in the period from 2015 through to 2019 was because of falling solar panel costs. So a price war in China for solar panels might not be beneficial for the solar panel sector, but it would be beneficial for consumers. So it's certainly worth paying attention to. Ultimately, we're going to have a really significant investment trend in energy independence. And the countries that successfully set aside idealism and try to deploy rational solutions are going to be those that are best insulated from future trouble. And nuclear has to be part of that discussion. So the uranium sector remains a potential beneficiary, but it's not going up right now. And the GlobalX ETF is coming back into the region of this 1,000-day moving average. So the challenge right now is that liquidity conditions are tightening, and everything outside of natural gas is experiencing stress. And we're still in a medium-term correction environment, and if yields break on the upside, well, then we really do have to start thinking about the potential that we're looking at the scope, at least, for asset prices to contract. And that could set up the potential for a secular bear market where you get valuation contraction and rising dividend yields over a lengthy period of time. We're not quite there yet, but if we see a significant number of major indices breaking down through their 1,000-day moving averages, we would have to conclude that the wider markets are going to endure a lengthier period of volatile trading, and valuation contraction could be a major factor within that. And I think with that, I'll leave you for the weekend, and I wish all the best to all of you.